Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are once again heading to France and looking at Jean Renoir's classic, The Grand Illusion. With me here today to talk about The Grand Illusion is Professor Marie Westaver. Professor Westaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this is the third time I've seen this movie, and you know, this is one of the best war films I still think ever made, and especially at that time, I think it's definitely one of the best in that era.
We're so used to World War II movies that I think a lot of people who watch this think it's a World War II movie. Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe it's actually about World War I, because name one other World War I movie off the top of your head.
Paths to Glory.
Okay. And name two.
All Quiet on the Western Front.
Three.
Okay. Now you got me that one.
Yep, see, it's hard. There's not a lot of really notable ones.
Mm-hmm. But those three, but yeah, definitely. And you know, but in this era, it does fit into this era of... We need to study like the history of like combat films. It does fit into this era pre-World War II films that just focused on World War I. They're all anti-war. I mean, the other one, obviously, is All Quiet on the Western Front. And I think this film does have quite a few similarities. And, you know, and it's funny that, you know, you have this anti-war sentiment, but you feel like a decade later, there's no way you could have made this film.
That's a very good point. You're probably right about that. Mm-hmm. Just because of the mood of it, and because it's a movie that's supposed to be about what they call poetic realism, which sounds like a dichotomy. How can something be poetic and yet realistic? But what they mean is using visual metaphors to put across things that are very realistic, meaning you don't try to make life seem happier than it really is. You show the depressing, darker side of things. And that's how people's mindset was after World War I, before World War II.
And, you know, it does show kind of World War I is sort of the last of its kind. You know, you can just tell things are changing. Like, the big thing is when Erich von Stroheim's character and the character of Dibble Doo, they're kind of even talking about how, you know, after, you know, our families aren't going to be really, we're declining, we're the last, and it's going to be the Rosenthals and the others that come over and take over.
Yes, and that's one of the main illusions in the film, is that class and aristocracy are things that are, they're becoming passé. And what were they really, what was the substance of that in the first place?
Yes, and you, like you said, the war feels like the grand illusion, because it... And when I first watched this a while ago, it was a bit distracting whenever they would just randomly break into English.
Well,
but it shows that they're multicultural.
Exactly. And I think they use language in a lot of... Renoir uses language in some interesting ways. You know, there's a point where the new prisoners are showing up and the ones, the old-timers, are singing and they're letting them know in the song that, you know, hide your stuff because they're going to take it away. And then later when... Jean Gabin's character wants to tell the incoming prisoners that they've built they've started digging a hole. He can't make himself understood.
Yeah, because he's British and he doesn't understand French.
There's lots of illusions, though. I mean, there's the grand illusion of friendship. There's the grand illusion of love. There's the grand illusion of safety. And then there's the negative ones, the grand illusion that a boundary between one country and another means anything. You know, you can't see it. It's completely man-made and artificial. Mm-hmm. And he said he came up with the title from the final scene. That at the very end, he thought that what he had put together was a series of illusions. And then the final one, where they escape into Switzerland, is the final illusion. Because the original script had them had it ending at Maxim's on Christmas Eve 1918. And it was supposed to end with an empty table. And you think, you know, they're either going to show up any minute, or even that was an illusion.
Hmm.
But he didn't shoot it that way.
Yeah. And I could do like the fact that he sort of leaves it up in the open. Yes, they've escaped. They're in Switzerland. And they're probably going to go back to the front lines, it looks like. But will they make it? Will he get back to the German woman?
Right.
You just don't know.
You don't know.
And it's, you know, it's interesting when you watch this movie, everybody for the most part is friendly towards another, even enemies. Like, you know, Erich von Stroheim is always very gentlemanly towards the French officer and even other French soldiers. He's not like just a few years later, the typical like tyrannical German Nazi officer who would do terrible things.
Right. Like from Schindler's List, where you have just a psychopath.
Yes.
Yeah, and one of the things about Renoir is he's very even-handed. He likes to give every chance to individuals and to ideas. So there's no quote unquote bad guys who, you know, always are doing bad things. And their very existence just seethes with evil. No, they're just people. And in fact, Renoir himself in Rules of the Game said, "You see, in this world, there is one awful thing, and that is that everyone has his reasons."
Hmm. It's interesting. And, you know, it's interesting when you watch this and everybody's mostly friendly, you're just sort of realizing, why are they fighting? You know, it's just that kind of like the film. You don't really know what's the point of them fighting. Everybody seems to get along mostly, well, even people of enemy countries. What's the whole point of this war?
Right. And I think that's one of the things that Renoir meant to say. In fact, he said, you know, "I made this movie, The Grand Illusion, in 1936, and in it I put every idea that I have, everything towards the cause of peace." And then 5 years later, war broke out.
And it does sort of, just in the film, it's, even though this was made before World War II happened, you can kind of tell that, you can see the seeds are planted for the World War II. That the one thing I noticed when Erich von Stroheim, there's that anti-Semitism by the German officer. You know,
right.
He's like, what is it, Rosenthal? You know, he has that stingingness when he says it. So you can just sort of tell that there's this anti-Semitism that's going to really kind of cause in Germany, which will lead into World War II.
But even our hero, Jean Gabin, near the end, when he and Rosenthal are stumbling around having escaped, they argue with each other and he calls him a dirty Jew.
Yeah, so even you know, the good guy.
Even the good guy.
And it's which was a good state in France, the Allies, they, even though there's still anti-Semitism there.
And this was a guy who shared his food and, you know, was his friend. It's an interest. You're right. It's a really good, you know, clue that this isn't really over.
Mm-hmm. And it does, you talked about that, it fights against the anti-Semitic stereotypes. Like, even though his name is Rosenthal, he comes from a very privileged background. He's very helpful. He's helping, you know, orchestrate escape efforts. He's happy to share his parcels or whatever he has with his men. So he really fights against that, you know, the rich, you know, cheapskate Flint or whatever.
Right, right.
And, you know, another thing I noticed was a bit also just that it hints just a tiny bit, but it talks about a bit of racism in the movie, because there's the African-American French soldier. He's sort of in the background, but in one scene he's painted a picture or something. He's trying to like, hey, look at this. And they just look at him, ignore him, and go, anyway, what I was talking about. So, you know, I wonder if it just sort of hints just the tiniest bit at the racism in Europe also towards African-Americans. I mean, African Europeans, I guess.
Or black people.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to say because they don't really do any more with it. And they don't have the same legacy of slavery that we do here. So we may be seeing it through an American lens.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I know, you know, the film also, the star is Jean Gabin. And he did this film. I know he did a few others with Jean Renoir. So was this like, you know, he was the huge French star at the time, right? He was like, I guess, the American version of Clark Gable in the 1930s.
Yeah, he was a huge star. Interestingly, he always seems to die at the end of most of his films, but he's the archetypical proletariat, the working class protagonist who meets his tragic destiny. But he's a very natural actor. When you see him on screen with, you know, the two actors who are trying to embody the old guard, the aristocracy, they hold themselves very stiffly, like an actor would on a stage. You know, the way that they handle themselves, it's just very stagey. Where Gabin, next to them, even though he looks a little rumpled, he's got this sort of Spencer Tracy air to him. He's sort of cool, but it's almost effortless. He's a terrific cinematic actor.
Yeah, he feels like the everyman in this movie, like the average soldier.
Right.
He acts like an average soldier. He has the same wants and needs and everything. He really plays that role well.
He doesn't know what cataract means. Yeah, he's just a regular guy.
Yeah, and then contrast that, I feel like his friend is the aristocrat Diabaudieu. And, you know, even when he talks with his friend, he's like, I can be okay around you. He's okay, but there's always this distance and separation. And he even talks about that when he decides to sacrifice. Like, how come I always have to be on stand on circumstance between you or something? I forget what the quote was. But it's like, you know, how come you always keep this distance? Even though we and I are friendly, you're always keeping this distance. And he says, well, to be fair, I do the same thing with my mom and wife.
Right. That's just how he is. He's very buttoned down, very rigid. And the rigidity comes in, you know, beautifully later with von Stroheim when he's actually been injured and he is wearing this corset. He is physically trapped in a cage. And I find that those scenes really interesting today because that neck brace that he wears makes him look just like Darth Vader when they take off the helmet. You know, he's holding his head in the same way, and he's the same sort of foreboding, scary guy, even though, you know, he's got a different side to him. Very Darth Vader.
Yeah, and he's even got the burns on his body because he got in an airplane accident.
Oh, and you got to love the fact that Renoir had no money to make this movie. So it's all about these aviators, but you don't see a single plane.
No, not one plane. They got a jacket. That's close enough.
They got a jacket. Yeah, and it's also interesting, very audacious for its time to say, well, you know, here we go. We're off on our mission. And then cut to the enemy walking and saying, well, blew them out of the sky. Yeah. No scene of any action.
But when I watched that, I was like, wait, what happened? Yeah. Did I miss a scene?
No, I think it wasn't like they cut it out. He just sort of elided over it.
Yeah. And it was interesting reading about a little bit of Renoir's biography. At this time, he was actually an aviator in World War I.
Yeah, his uniform was the one that you see Jean Gabin wearing in the movie.
Yeah, and I know he also suffered a bad leg injury in which I think that just he had to carry the rest of his life. And while he was recuperating, that's when he watched people like Charlie Chaplin and D.W. Griffith, and he realized, oh, this is something I want to do. And I think after the war, that's when he started making movies.
He has a really wonderful eye. It's no accident that he's related to the famous painter. But his approach to setting up a scene is so much different from other directors who use the camera as a frame and then try to make something picturesque within it. Renoir uses the camera as a viewfinder and moves the camera all the time.
Definitely.
You know, rather than cutting, he'll circle an entire table full of people so he doesn't have to cut. But it also gives you, the viewer, this sense that you're part of the action, that you're in it with them.
Yeah, the two scenes I really liked what he did with the camera was the one scene when they're getting ready for that play in the prison, and the one French guy is dressing up as a woman, and then he just zooms around and just see all the men looking at him. It's just because you can, it doesn't have to say anything, you know what's going on. They haven't seen a woman in so long, even this guy in drag is starting to look appealing to them.
Yes.
And the other scene I liked is when we see Eric von Stroheim for the second time, and this is after the accident, and we just see all the collections of stuff he has. He's got the collection of gloves. He has all these portraits and paintings and everything. You can tell even though he's a soldier, even though he's an aviator and everything, he still wants to keep this upper-class aristocracy towards him.
There's also another wonderful scene where Gabin is in prison, and he has tried to break out a couple of times, and he pretends to be, you know, losing his mind, so they let down their guard, and then he tries to make a break for it. And any other director would have followed him all the way out of the door to where they captured him and dragged him back. But Renoir just leaves the camera there until they drag him back. It's just a different way of looking at it that's so fresh because it's unexpected.
Yeah, and I think he was just showing that, like, you know, there's no way in heck he was going to make that escape. It's just such a pathetic attempt. Why even bother looking at it?
And he also was the kind of director that did not like to set up, you know, two talking heads, you know, speaking to each other the way you would like a photography studio. In his mind, you should always have the sense that outside of your frame was action going on, not like people being backstage, but, you know, things actually happening. And then if he moved the camera, you know, you would capture it, which is why that works in that scene I just was talking about with Jean Gabin trying to run out of the room. You know, you can leave the camera there because you know he's coming back. Mm-hmm. You know that action's happening off screen. You can imagine it, but you don't really need to move the camera to see it.
Yeah, not necessary. And, you know, interesting, we were talking about directors on this show. We also have Eric von Stroheim. And, you know, during his time as a silent movie director, he was very well regarded. But, you know, I noticed that starting in the 30s, he started moving away from directing and becoming an actor. And, you know, he's most famously known as the butler in Sunset Boulevard. So after the 20s, did he just stop directing it altogether?
You know, Hollywood turned their back on him and he went to Europe to make his fame and fortune. And did pretty well there. Yeah, he was a wonderful and well-regarded director of silent film, but very difficult to work for. Like, very autocratic, you know, wanted things his way, had a hard time getting along with people.
You see that with a lot of German directors. I know Fritz Lang and Otto Preminger were both very difficult to work with and could be very harsh and pretty brutal towards their actors and actresses.
I think also when you're making a film about the wars, you know, you can bring in that sort of stereotype as well, where you, you know, as soon as you see Eric von Stroheim, you already know so much about him as an actor, person, director. It sort of adds to the whole mystique of what the character in this movie must be like.
And he played another German officer. He actually played one of Billy Wilder's first films in America was Seven Graves to Cairo. And he plays actually Rommel in that movie, another German officer.
Yeah, typecasting maybe.
And so other characters in the film, I noticed Cartier, and I don't remember the actor's name. He was he's the comic relief in the film at the beginning of the thing. And you know, I noticed he was also in a couple other Renoir films. He was in Rules of the Game and The Human Beast. The actor, I can't remember his name.
Yeah, he's a terrific actor in that, and he's in the other movies that you mentioned as well.
And so this film was this like some of the one of the first like big hits of as far as reception goes, like internationally?
You know, I think he suffered from being compared to his famous father. So I don't think people wanted to give him a break. They thought, oh, you're just, you know, a kid who's had all the advantages. But this movie did really well. This was one of the movies that he made where everybody liked it. In fact, it played in the United States for something like 15 weeks. And a major first run house in New York, and then there's mass distribution afterwards. And President Roosevelt said, everyone who believes in democracy should see this film.
Wow.
So I think everybody did.
And I know it actually, at the Oscars, it got a Best Picture nomination, which at that time, a foreign film getting a Best Picture nomination is pretty impressive.
It's actually impressive at any time, but yeah. You're right, especially then. That was really unusual.
And, you know, watching this film, there are quite a few scenes that call later to, like, remembering other classic war films. Like, when they're at the play and they stop it because they've just received news that the French has retaken a fort, and they all get up and start singing the French national anthem.
Yeah.
Like, you just watch that, and you can't help but think of Casablanca.
Right.
And then... And even sort of like that comic relief character we've talked about, he's sort of like the comic relief character in Stalag 17. And you know, and even when they're digging the tunnel and they're even doing that method where they pretend like they're guarding and get rid of the dirt, you just can't help but think of The Great Escape. So there definitely you can see how it's influenced a lot of later war films.
Yeah, and I think I think it's very definite that the scene from Casablanca is referencing that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in both cases, you have a woman. One's a real woman. One's a guy dressed as a woman. I mean, I don't think that's an accident.
Yeah, and so you were talking a little bit about Renoir's earlier life. So his father was a very famous painter?
Yes, and I think when you look at how Renoir like frames things, he doesn't, for example, if he's like, he was very interested in making movies with his wife, and he shot her from every available angle. It's just very lovingly rendered. But it wasn't about, here is this beautiful woman, look at how beautiful she is. It was about, like a painter, showing a universal beauty, bringing out a universal beauty with the medium that he had. And I think he and Kate inherited all those artistic skills. He just used a different crayon.
Yeah. And so, you know... This film, would you say, is like if somebody wanted to learn like early French cinema pre-World War II, particularly the 1930s, would you say this film is like a really good starting point?
Yeah, and I would say Renoir in general is a really good starting point because he's probably the most famous French director ever, but especially in terms of poetic realism. André Bazin, who wrote a lot for Cahiers du Cinéma, really admired Renoir and was working on a book about the director when he died. But he thought that Renoir's work always had sympathy, and he was impressed with his artistic flair, doing things with the camera that people hadn't done before. So I think he was an artist, a true artist.
Mm-hmm. And definitely the sympathy you're talking about. It's sort of just the last 20 minutes of that film where they're at the house of the German woman. You really feel that love story. And when he, you know, he's leaving her, and then he says, why aren't you going to look back? He's like, if I look back, I'll probably stay. And that you do feel that heartbreak in romance in the movie. You really feel it.
And some of that's done through visual imagery. You know, she says, you know, my husband's dead and, you know, the table is too big. And then you see a shot of the table and it's a large table and the only one sitting there is her daughter. And then they join in and then they've sort of got this instant family. and the table's full. And then when they leave, they go back and show you the shot of the table and the little girl's there and the table's empty.
Yeah,
again.
That's heartbreaking, that last shot when, you know, it's back to being normal with her being alone.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen five Renoir films. I've seen this one. I've seen Rules of the Game, The Lower Depths, The Human Beast, and then the guy, Baudu Saved from Drowning.
Yes.
And so, you know, all of them, I'm not a huge fan of Rules of the Game. I don't know. It just didn't work for me. The others I really like. And so, would you say that this was like his best era in the 30s?
Definitely. And the movies you named are all part of the essential canon, I would say. But, you know, and I am with you about the Rules of the Game. I have tried so many times to watch that movie and feel what people express about it, which is, you know, it's a masterpiece and it's witty and it's interesting because there's all this nod, wink, you know, to people who are in the know about aristocracy. And I don't get it. And I've tried several times. I cannot. I don't understand that movie.
I would say there are parts that I think are pretty funny. I know even Renoir himself is in it. Right?
Yes. He plays a character who makes that statement about, you know, the terrible thing. The truth is that, you know, unfortunately, everybody has their reasons.
Yeah, I watched it. I mean, like I said, there are parts that I do think are pretty funny. But I don't know. Maybe I was expecting a little bit more slapstick because the poster kind of shows all these people running around doing goofy things. But I don't know. And you talk about how it's sort of in the know of aristocracy, but not all of us were alive in France in the 1930s. So maybe now with the more modern audience, that's lost on a lot of people who weren't around to an experience that time.
That's what I would like to think. I have heard people rave about what a great movie it is. So I just wonder if it's an intellectual failing of mine that I cannot grasp the story. And it does not hold my interest. It starts off with, you know, the aviator who wants to woo a woman, but it doesn't pan out to any sort of romantic movie. It's a setup that leaves you bewildered later.
Yes, but I think this movie is my favorite of the ones I've seen. Baudu Saved from Drowning is pretty funny. Another one I think is probably my second favorite, I would say, is The Human Beast.
Or The Lower Depths.
Yeah, that's a good one, too.
That's sort of pre-war or in between the wars. That's, sort of leading up to.
And I know he actually, during World War II, he moved to Hollywood, right?
He did. And he did have some, you know, he was well-regarded and, you know, the toast of the town. Mm-hmm. But he never really went Hollywood. He never really made a movie that was different from what he was doing in France and, you know, kind of like he didn't make an action movie or anything like that.
Yeah, because I was looking at, so have you seen any of his French, American movies worth watching, would you say?
I would say if you wanted to watch Renoir, the thing to do is to watch his movies from the 30s.
Yeah, I would say that too. And so I'm getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything we haven't brought up that you'd like to bring up now?
Well, I think that when you watch the movie, it is important to think of all the different illusions that he is putting forth. You know, the falseness of all the barriers of prejudice separating man from man. All of those big ideas are really well served by the movie. I think this is his best, and I think there's a lot to think about there.
Mm-hmm. I would definitely say that. And then, so last question I have, I know you're probably getting tired of me asking this question already, but how would you bring this film into your French film course?
Well, I showed some scenes from Rules of the Game, and of course I showed the famous scene from Sunset Boulevard with Gloria Swanson being ready for her close-up. And it's really an interesting scene to use anyway, because it's also Van Stroheim playing a guy who is, his time is over.
And he was a director.
Yeah.
The character was a director.
The character, was a director who, sort of fell out of favor with Hollywood and ended up, you know, being the yes man to this famous actress. That's not how Renoir's life went by any means, but it's but Van Stroheim playing that kind of character it's almost like he's showing you a side of himself. So I show that scene. We talk a little bit about the Marseillaise in Casablanca, and then we dive right into Rules of the Game.
Okay.
I'm sorry. The Grand Illusion.
The Grand Illusion.
The Rules of the Grand Illusion.
Okay. All right, well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about French director Jean Renoir and his war classic, The Grand Illusion. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m. or anytime at armchairdirectors.podomatic.com. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. For the Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, for me, it's simple. A golf course is for golf, a tennis court is for tennis, a prison camp is for escaping.